Back with you for a Monday, Connecticut Today, Monday, May 2nd, 2022. I said that I think the current policy of free rides on all CT Transit buses that'll be in effect till at least the end of the fiscal year should be made permanent. Let's find the money for that. We brought you highlights from Governor Ned Lamont's Monday news conference from earlier in the day. Southern Connecticut State University biologist Dr. Sarah Crawford returned to the show again to talk about the progress of the latest BA2 COVID-19 subvariant. I mentioned something, if you remember. Oh, of course I do, Paul. Everything you say sticks with me. No. I mentioned this must have been about 3 or 4 months ago. And this is when the notion of allowing free bus rides to people on CT Transit first started to pop up, when they were talking about, well, are we going to lower the gas tax? We're going to do a break in the state gas tax, the 25-cent tax, right? Remember that? Remember when that popped up a few months ago? And they said one of the goodies in that package that we have going now until at least the end of the fiscal year, June 30th, or the end of the year, depending upon what happens up in Hartford, is that you can now ride CT Transit bus service free, at least temporarily, till the end of the fiscal year. Well, now there are calls for that to become permanent. And if you remember a few months ago, hope you do, I thought that would have been a great idea months ago. Now, I'm already getting blowback from it because I put that as our Facebook question of the day. And if you want to check it out, you can go to facebook.com/WICC600. Why don't we make all CT Transit bus rides? Why don't we make it free? It's free now. It did cost something before we did this 3-month holiday, this gas tax holiday. Simple question. Why don't we make it free? Wouldn't doing this solve a lot of stuff when you think about it? Now, I know people are going to say, well, you know, that's not really fair. Why isn't it fair? Well, Paul, that money's got to come from somewhere. Yeah, okay, I get it. I understand that. But why not make maybe not every bus run, but make certain bus runs free? Why not all those CT Transit buses in Bridgeport, in Hartford, in New Haven, all around the state, in some of these suburban routes, down in lower Fairfield County, make them free? Riders are getting used to riding free, says here in the Hearst, Connecticut Media, Mark Zaretsky's story here. They like the free rides. The call is now going out from various quarters to make it permanent, or at least, which may happen at minimum, extended to December 1st. Hartford, for example, 30% of residents in Hartford don't own cars. In New Haven, the Board of Alders and the Elm City, too, say they are looking at a similar percentage of folks who don't own cars there. Just across the northern border, city council folks in Springfield are also pushing for it. Some CT Transit officials have told local transit officials they're in favor of offering fare free bus service because the amount Connecticut makes through fare collection is barely worth the cost of collections. Who knew this? One local transit official really recently told that to the South Central Regional Council of Governments. A couple of key legislators said the possibility of extending the fare-free bus program to December 1st might actually happen. So at least till the end of the year. Now, I know a lot of people like to say, well, you know, people should get out and find jobs. People should contribute more to society. Well, why not give them a free bus ride or two back and forth every day to, you know, get to work, get to school, get to where they're going, and maybe it's something, it's less of a burden that they're worrying about, saying, hey, I go to this job, I finally got a job, but it's a pain in the rear to get there. I don't have a car, number one. I don't have the money to insure it, even if I did have that car, number two. And even if I did have the car and the insurance, gas is $4 and change right now. So this seems to be a no-brainer. Now, one person said here, bus fares accounted for $43 million in revenue in 2019. This is said by DOT Deputy Commissioner Garrett Yucalito in an emailed statement here to the Hearst, Connecticut media folks. Yucalito saying bus fares accounted for $43 million in revenue in 2019. Elimination of all fares would necessitate finding alternative revenue or appropriations to support operations or a reduction in services or reduce costs by a comparable level. Well, why don't we see if it can happen? Now, here is one downside to this. I think when you think about this, there is one, I think, thing they would have to deal with, they being law enforcement, they being the folks that run the bus system. And look, you got to say this because you know it's a problem. If there's no cost to ride the buses, right, how do you keep those buses from essentially becoming rolling homeless shelters? Think about that. How do you keep those buses from becoming rolling homeless shelters? Because if there's no cost to get on, as is being proposed now by, you know, some big city lawmakers all around the state, if the state basically eats that cost of, what, $40 or $43 million a year, what's to stop someone from just staying on the bus all day? Think about that. Sean Scanlon, state rep, Democrat from Guilford, House Chair of the Finance, Revenue, and Bonding Committee, both said, though, an extension to the free bus rides is on the table. He said, though, however, the buses and trains in Connecticut are heavily subsidized. They don't bring in anywhere near what it costs to run them, but I certainly understand the desire to extend it, and we're pushing for it. Well, I think you should, if you're really serious. See, now this is where I ring the bell here on a little hypocrisy there, right? We got to get cars off the road. We have to cut down on emissions. We want to have better urban connection or suburban connection to and from our cars and our work and our people. Well, why not make the buses free? That gets cars off the road. Now, to what extent it does, I don't know. You probably get cars off the road. You probably use less polluting emission standards here. But again, it's kind of being poo-pooed on. Is it really the money thing, or is there a fear, as I say, you know, is there a fear there that this becomes in lack of a better phrase here, a rolling homeless shelter? Is that the fear maybe that is being, you know, not spoken here? What do you think? 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. What about if they took that money from tax revenue from you and I around the state? There are 3 million people in the state here. I don't know how many pay taxes, but in the grand scheme of a $24 billion state budget, is $43 million really a lot to say we're going to subsidize all bus rides? I don't think it is. What are you doing, Paul? Are you turning lefty on us? No, not really. But I will call out something that I think makes a little sense, maybe. Don't you? So again, all CT Transit bus rides are free through June 30th. Should that become permanent? Would that help commuters and job seekers? As we mentioned to you earlier in the show, the state is now awash. I mean, we're talking gobs and gobs and gobs of money between tax revenue, between federal COVID money, between a whole bunch of stuff here. And Governor Ned Lamont met members of the media today to talk about that and a whole bunch of stuff that is cooking up in Hartford. You may have missed it, so let's give you some of what Ned Lamont told reporters today. He started off with questions or with a statement about all this extra money the state has and what they may do or may not do about it.
These revised revenue estimates are really an important shining light for this state. And coming after decades of fiscal crisis, boom, bust, back and forth, what that did to the confidence of this state, this is our third year of surplus. And it's that first year was a tough one. This time around, I want to end one misstatement right now. There's no ARPA money. This is not being balanced with federal money. This is being balanced with the fact that our income tax and our sales tax are doing well, and also by the fact that we're making key investments going forward and doing everything we can to balance the budget, honestly. So what a difference that makes. A couple of other misconceptions. A lot of people say, that's great. It's the largest tax cut in the history of the state, but it doesn't kick in for over a year. You've heard a lot about that. That's false. You know, first and foremost, we were the third state in the country to get that gasoline tax cut, 25-cent cut right now. It went into effect the very next day, and you saw prices at the pump drop. I believe it was 24 cents. And what a difference that makes. We've got a cut in the car tax, as you heard described. You're going to get that bill on July 2nd, and you can get that savings, you know, virtually that same month. These are tax cuts that are going to make a difference for you right now, right in the middle of this inflationary period. Working with the finance chairs, I want you to know that when it comes to the EITC, the Earned Income Tax Credit, as well as the Child Tax Credit, that is money that is going to be made available to you this summer, so you don't have to wait. So I'd like to end that misconception. Oh, this is all, this may be the biggest tax cut in the history of the state, but we have to wait for it. That's not true. And we're not shortchanging the future. And Dr. Anwar, just want you to know that when it comes to the ARPA revenues, we've got the money in place to deal with COVID going forward. I can't tell you whether we've got one or two more variants coming. You and I talk a lot about what happens in the fall, and we're going to be ready, and we're not depleting what we need for public health. Last thing I'd just like to add is a lot of people say, oh my gosh, this is so much money. It's just sitting in the bank. It's burning a hole in our pocket. Let's spend it now or give away more now. And there's never been a great appetite to pay down or unfunded pension liability. Usually during a campaign, everybody's talking about it. In my last campaign, I remember they were talking about, it's so big, we're not going to be able to honor our commitment to state employees. Let's tear up the contract. Let's file for bankruptcy. Let's walk away from our obligations. Look, I'm doing everything I can to recruit and keep the best trained workforce in the state right now. And part of that is honoring the commitments you make to people. I think what we're doing now with something like a $3.6 billion contribution to start continue paying down our pension obligations on top of $1.6 billion says a couple of things. It says to our state employees, we honor the commitments we made, and you can count upon it. It also says something for taxpayers, and it says something for legislators and governors. You know, usually every you just keep increasing the mortgage and borrowing more against the pension fund and say we're going to pay it next year, we're going to pay it in the next decade, and we're going to do it later. And you know what that means? That means your ongoing obligations to bring that up true keep going up every year. And that's why Connecticut, with its fixed cost, people say it's like running a marathon in cement overshoes. We're changing that dynamic. With this $5-plus billion contribution to the state pension over last year and this year, as you heard Jeff say, that's going to save taxpayers. That's going to save over $440 million a year. Those are reduced contributions that we no longer have to make on the backs of taxpayers right now because we're reducing that. And then when people say, oh, my God, what's going to happen when the ARPA goes? What's going to happen if there's a rainy day? What happens if the world changes? We're going to be as ready as you can be. We're going to be as ready because we've got the biggest rainy day fund in the history of the state. We're going to be ready because we're allocating our ARPA over a period of time, so there's a glide path to what we want to do. And we're going to be ready because we're able to save taxpayers about $440 million a year that you no longer have to contribute to the pension fund because of the $5 billion payment we've paid right now. Nothing is guaranteed in the future, and there are some storm clouds out there. And I know that this year's surplus does not imply the same for next year, but I want you to know we're operating cautiously, planning for the future, making the investments where we ought to make the investments to keep our economy growing again.
All right. There's some of what Governor Ned Lamont said earlier today. Going to have more of it on the other side of traffic and weather again. And we'll come back with some comments. You know, one thing that, although that, you know, he's pointing out truths in this, there is something that never happens. We'll tell you about that coming up first. More with the governor after traffic and weather together here, WICC. And we continue with some comments earlier today from Governor Ned Lamont talking about the fiscal state of the state, kind of some remarks he made at an AARP gathering. The governor was asked kind of the second part, or a couple of more minutes here we'll give you, of his remarks on tax cuts, what tax cuts are going to happen. He was asked by a member of the Hartford Press Corps, hey, the Republicans in the House and Senate saying, well, wait a minute, why don't you use some money here for tax cuts other than the property tax, the auto tax, use it for more broad-based tax cuts? And the governor responds that the state may very well be on shaky ground if they were to go ahead and try and do something like that, with the chance that the state may have to pay some stuff back in the future.
And we know that it's illegal under ARPA rules, but Governor, we recommend you sue the federal government. We still do the tax cuts. Hopefully we win, because if we lose, then we'd have to give the money back, and that'd be a really bad thing. It didn't make any sense to me. This is the largest tax cut in the history of the state. It's justifiable, allowed under the rules. And Sue, I'll just say one other thing on the unemployment thing, because I've been maybe the guy, a bit of a fly in the ointment on this. We get that money for 1.5%. So if it's $100 million I put into the unemployment, that saves the taxpayers of the state or the small business about $1.5 million. When I pay down pension, that's like 7% money. So every time I pay down the pension, say $100 million, that's $7 million. So I'm trying to allocate the money in the way that makes the biggest difference for the taxpayers of the state of Connecticut. We paid down over $200 million of federal money right now under the unemployment. And by the way, it's worth noting, we have the lowest claims on unemployment really in the history of the state. So that means it's paying itself down at about $250 million a year. So, but that said, you know, we sat down with the legislature, we made an arrangement.
So that overall balance then should...
It's going down by itself to the tune of about $250 a year. Jeff's still here? There's Jeff. Yeah.
Was there any discussion, also as Paul mentioned over there, any discussion of cutting the diesel tax? The Republicans somehow always mention diesel, truckers pay that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Was there any...
Not in my mind. I'll tell you why. I like to cut taxes that the Connecticut people pay. And the diesel tax is overwhelmingly paid by truckers, most of which are coming from out of state, driving through our state and heading on down to Florida. So that was not a priority for me.
The diesel tax or suspension is not part of this budget.
That's correct.
It's just the regular car tax.
Just gas tax, exactly.
That was a free bus transit. That was in the initial holiday.
Yeah, that's been continued through December 1st.
Can you talk about today's new report, the joint report that shows an additional $1 billion from capital gains and dividends, and whether that changes the budget? Does that increase the amount of tax under the formula? Does that increase the amount of tax relief you're allowed to give?
I think we've reached an agreement on the $600 million. You're absolutely right. That does adjust what you're allowed to do under the de minimis rule, et cetera. But to your bigger point, Dan, we have a very volatile revenue stream. And when things are going well, things are going very well. I'm the little bit of a note of caution here. I see what's going on in capital gains, not to mention a contracting economy over the last month. I see a Federal Reserve that's beginning to raise interest rates, and I want to make sure that we're ready for that, and we are.
All right, so there you go. That's some of the governor's remarks. I wanted to bring those to you because I want to be able to give you folks something more than just a couple of sound bites on the TV news or a couple of paragraphs or a couple of quotes in a print publication. But here's the thing. Again, the governor gets up there and he says, well, this is the biggest tax cut. This is the biggest tax cut we've ever done. It was the biggest tax cut that's been done, whatever, in a couple of years. Okay, so on paper, that may be true. But again, it's not broad-based. When they say, I'm telling you this all the time, when they say targeted tax cuts, that is a phrase on both sides of the aisle, but usually for Democrats. That means targeted tax cuts means where are we going to get votes from? I'm sorry if you don't think that is, but that's exactly where it is. Again, property taxes, right? Not everybody pays property taxes. You know, the grandiose thinking that this is somehow a great financial and fiscal day for the state, it's nuts. It just isn't. It just isn't. And I know it's an election year, and I know what the governor's trying to do. I understand that. You know, but the notion that some property tax cuts in a state where a lot of people don't own property and will see zero benefit from that is something big. And talking about leveling out the car taxes in a state where a lot of people don't own cars, don't own vehicles, and they will see exactly zero benefit from that. So, you know, take it with a healthy grain of salt, one or two grains at least. Understand where these tax cuts are targeted, wink, wink, and where they're not. Again, there is no effort. There is never an effort from the Democratic side of the aisle. There just isn't. I'm sorry. You can call me partisan. I'll wrap my arms around that. There's never an effort to give a little bit of relief to the sales tax or the income tax, while a lot of other states do it. I was reading over the weekend of states that are readjusting their sales taxes, their property tax rates, not a credit as this is, because nothing here is ever broad-based. It just isn't. It just isn't a broad-based tax relief scenario where, hey, let's give everybody a little break, just a little bit, on the sales tax or on the income tax, because there will never be the votes in the majority party in Hartford to do that. And the governor knows it. He knows that. And that's why he says, well, look at how great this is. He knows in his mind, you can obviously tell he's not a dummy when it comes to numbers. You don't get a net worth like Ned Lamont has with numbers if you're dumb. He ain't. But he knows what he can get, and he's got to play the game. To the subject of COVID-19, the latest subvariant and how we are doing there and what could be coming now. Hopefully better news if the warmer weather is coming up. One of our go-to folks since this thing all started 2+ years ago, and we had these people on a regular basis, Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University, joins us. Dr. Crawford, Paul here again. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm fine. It's a pleasure to talk again.
Well, thanks, Dr. Crawford. We appreciate it. Well, I'm looking at the daily numbers here for Connecticut that come over about 3 o'clock every day, as you know. Positivity test for the rolling past 7 days, just a hair under 9%, 8.85%, about 230 people currently hospitalized around the state, doctor, with some manner of COVID-19. We don't know the severity. Those numbers tell you anything? How should we interpret the numbers we're hearing now on a daily basis?
Well, I think the numbers in Connecticut are reflective of what's going on in the Northeast. New York City today went up to medium alert. Clearly, the Omicron 2 is in full swing here. And it's causing an uptick, considerable change in the incidence of infection. Fortunately, the state of illness in terms of severity is not too bad for most people. But I think it is something to be watching out for, especially since a lot of the mask mandates and other precautionary measures are being put aside based on our hopeful feeling that this is all over. We're not quite there yet.
I did read a couple of experts, Doctor, over the weekend, pretty much echo what you said, but they also said, both of them, hey, there's still about a 5 to 10% chance here of a major rebound that could send us back to wide mandates, could send us into even more inoculations. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree. I think we're not in a stable situation. As long as we have the continuing emergence of variants, and now we see in South Africa there's a BA4 and a BA5 in the pipeline coming up, which that's where Omicron started. So that's something to be concerned about. We have China, which is in a very serious predicament right now, thousands and millions of people on lockdown because there's a zero tolerance policy. And if were COVID to break loose there, all bets are off in terms of what types of mutants might emerge. So I think we're at a time where we're sort of doing watchful waiting. We're going to be seeing what's going to happen, but we can't predict with any certainty. But clearly, this is not over yet, and there is still a risk that very serious variants could emerge.
You mentioned, Dr. Crawford, China, and I've been following this closely. Yeah, it's a zero-tolerance policy. We can really see that, where people are basically kept prisoner in their homes or apartments, or if they're not sick, there's been, a forced takeover of some of the places they're living for people who are sick. Would the Chinese, you think, be doing this if it was one of the previous variants or something we know how to deal with? Or do you think there might be more going on here or not?
Well, I think it's hard to say with certainty since they're not very revealing in terms of what's going on. But I think we have several factors. We're not sure how well vaccinated the population is. We're not sure how well the vaccine that they're using works. And we're not sure what the variant status is over there. They're doing a lot of testing. I'm not sure exactly what data they are releasing. So there's always the possibility, if you're dealing with a poorly vaccinated community, that you're going to have higher incidence of new variants emerging. And it really is a black box, and it is something that the unknowns are cautionary in terms of this is where it all started. And we cannot, at our own risk, we ignore this.
Dr. Sarah Crawford's the guest. Dr. Hangout, we'll be right back with you. And when we come back, we'll get her opinion on the second booster that, from what I read, not a lot of people are taking, but we'll ask her about that. And some news that has come out about this pill form of therapy, this Paxlovid, over the weekend. We'll get her opinion on that and more. First, traffic and weather together right here, WICC. Dr. Sarah Crawford's been with us several times in the past 2+ years to talk about what is going on with COVID-19. She teaches at SCSU, Southern Connecticut State University, professor of biology there. Dr. Crawford, on the second booster, I got mine. I'm well over 50, but I got it, and no real big side effects here. But from what I understand, the uptake on the second booster is not where experts thought it would be or where they would like. What are your thoughts on the second booster, and we're going to see more of this down the road?
Well, yes, it's a complicated question. Late March, the second booster was approved for those over 50 and individuals who are immunocompromised. So that certainly is advisable. However, data from Israel suggests that the immunity wanes very quickly after the fourth booster, that within 4 to 6 weeks, your levels of antibodies are back down to where they were pre-booster. So that it's a questionable significance in terms of protection. Certainly short term, yes, but we're dealing with a protracted pandemic here. So I'm not sure exactly how beneficial it is. I think one of the issues here that complicates the situation is the Omicron and the fact that its spike is so different. The BA2 is so different from where we were earlier in the pandemic with the variants around then, that the antibody response is not good and not lasting for that particular variant. So there are some issues with the vaccine. It's not an insurance card. It's a preventative tool, but it's certainly not a guarantee that you won't get sick.
So it sounds like, doctor, in layman's terms here, the body is always playing catch up here, trying to say, oh, here's another new one now. I've got to put this in the circular file, right?
Yes. There's a lot of research going on now to see where immunity stands with the vaccines, without vaccines. And it's clear that there is a good sustained T-cell response, which is the long-term immunity to the virus, to the Omicron, which is very exciting because there was concern that this might be an issue. Antibodies don't respond well, but it seems like the T-cells do, which may be why the infection is not so severe as it might be. So I think that that is good. But there's a lot more research that needs to be done to see where we are in terms of these vaccines, because at this point, we're not getting a durable response, and that is very concerning.
To Paxlovid, doctor, which, as you well know and people may know, is the Pfizer pill form here of the therapy for COVID-19. Kind of some mixed news I read over the weekend. I guess prophylactically, or as a preventative measure, it didn't quite cut the mustard, did it?
No. Well, it's really not designed to. It is a treatment. It's not a vaccine. So the idea is that if you've been exposed to COVID, if you have the infection and you take the Paxlovid early on, it weakens the ability of the virus to spread in the body. However, that being said, there are some cases of breakthrough that the drug brings down the virus for a certain period of time, but then there's a rebound effect in certain individuals where they get a second round of illness. So even the treatment is not 100% necessarily. And the idea is not that you're going to prevent infection. The idea is to mitigate, to make it less, to make the side effects less serious in terms of immune system consequences. But again, as encouraging as it is to have a therapeutic, it's certainly not a magic pill.
Are we getting, Dr. Crawford, any better grip here? And maybe this was illustrated more in the early parts of this, as to why some seemingly healthy, virile young people or younger people get hit hard. And yet you see these stories of people in their 70s and 80s, and early on there were some people in their 90s who had it rough but were able to get through this, and why some people end up in a hospital and some don't. You know, if you strain out all the mitigating factors of obesity and other sublying conditions, do we have any better grip as to why there's such a wide variety and who gets this thing bad and who doesn't?
Well, I think we have some pretty good demographics. We know who the vulnerable populations are, certainly older individuals, immunocompromised individuals. I think the problem is that you're always going to have outliers. Each human being is unique, and we don't really know very often what the underlying factors might be. There may be issues with the immune system that are not transparent and don't show up in regular testing. And the system is put to the test, in effect, when you get a disease like COVID. And this is where you're going to see individuals who have compromised immune systems and other types of complicating metabolic issues that may not be obvious, where that effect could be very serious. And thank goodness it is rare, but it does happen. And I think, again, there's no reason why we should be complacent about this, regardless of our age or our status of health currently.
Dr. Sarah Crawford, thank you. Professor of Biology, Southern Connecticut State University. Have a wonderful day, rest of the month, and we'll check with you down the road as the weather warms. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Paul.
Appreciate it. Appreciate it. Dr. Sarah Crawford there, biology professor at Southern Connecticut State University.